Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for listening to NPR News here on the radio or online or on the podcast. Coming up, we'll have a visit with Minnesota Congressman and the DNC Vice Chair, Keith Ellison. But first, more on that report that came out last week that studied the salt that is in the lakes around the Twin Cities metro. We can point to road salt runoff and our own overuse of salt in the winter on our driveways as the problem. The report also says this, by 2050, if these salt levels keep rising, none of the lakes in the metro will be able to support native fish and plants. Freshwater lakes just aren't meant to have that much salt. We have three guests here to talk about this and to take your calls. Brooke Oslison is with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Mindy Morales-Williams is a doctoral researcher at the University of Minnesota, one of the co-authors on this report as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And Steve Lund joins me on the phone from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. He is the state maintenance engineer, so there are questions of the road salt use that cross his desk. Steve, you think about this a lot, and I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
What questions do you have about this? Call now 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Tweet me at WeberTom1, and please don't call or text if you're driving. Brooke, it's a pretty stark headline to say we won't have any fish in our lakes anymore here in the metro. How bad is it? Just put this into context.
Well, we do have a number of surface water bodies and some groundwater that we know has high levels of chloride in them. And we recently completed a study that looked into the sources and what can we do to reduce the salt use for 39 of those surface waters that are actually above that 230 milligram per liter threshold that has been set to protect aquatic insects and fish in our lakes and streams.
And you're saying chloride, but we're talking about salt.
We are talking about salt. So salt is typically sodium chloride, sometimes magnesium chloride or calcium chloride, but chloride is the component of salt that is actually toxic to our aquatic insects and fish.
And Mindy, I know you were focusing on specific elements of this study, but broader. I mean, this is from the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, and it's billed as the first large-scale analysis of chloride, aka salt, trends in the U.S., studying more than 300 lakes in the U.S. and Canada, so Minnesota not alone.
That's right. Yeah, this study looked at 371 lakes across the U.S. And in Ontario, 284 were in the North American Lake region, so in the northern United States.
So how does salt actually affect aquatic life?
Sure. Well, as you pointed out, things that live in freshwater like to live in freshwater. They don't like to live in marine systems. And so as you start to increase the salt concentrations, you can change the balance of communities in these systems. So native fish might not have the same tolerance ranges. You start to favor things like cyanobacteria or blue-green algae that have a higher tolerance for salt concentrations relative to other organisms.
Big picture, you're talking about choking the fish in some way or no?
Well, not directly choking the fish. It would have to be really very high concentrations for that. What can happen is because salt is very dense, it can keep the lake from mixing and cause bottom waters to go hypoxic or have very little or no oxygen. Fish need oxygen. And so they could choke in that respect, but the concentrations would have to be quite high for them for salt to have toxic effects on the fish.
And Brooke, this isn't the first time we've talked about this, and then also talked, and we'll talk to Steve here in a minute, about the things we do here in the Minnesota in the winter.
Right. And so that was the goal of our study, was to really look at what are all of the different sources of chloride, because the salt we're putting on our roads, parking lots, and driveways is one of the source. And of course, in the metro area is the primary source. But there are other sources of chloride, like water softening. So if you have a groundwater is your supply for drinking water, which about 75% of Minnesotans rely on groundwater as their drinking water source. A lot of the time that groundwater is going to be hard. And so people will put in water softeners in their homes, and that adds chloride to the waste stream, which then goes to the wastewater treatment facilities and gets directly discharged into our surface waters. So more rural parts of the state, water softening is actually a bigger source of chloride for our surface waters. And then we wanted to understand, well, what can we do about it? You know, we know that we need to be proactive and we need to get ahead of this, because chloride is a permanent pollutant. It's something that will not break down over time. It doesn't like to bind to soil particles or anything. It'll just stay with that water essentially forever. Wherever that water goes, the chloride's going to stick with it, and we really don't have a way to remove that from our surface waters or our groundwater for that matter. We could remove it using reverse osmosis, but that's a very expensive treatment process.
One of the researchers, the lead researcher, Hillary Dugan, notes in some of the articles I've read about this, Brooke, our main finding was that any lake surrounded by some type of impervious surface, meaning a road or a parking lot, was more at risk of having long-term salination, which probably to you, Brooke, doesn't surprise you to hear a conclusion like that. But then I think about all the metro lakes. I think about the chain of lakes, for example, in Minneapolis. They all have roads going around them, especially in urban areas.
Yeah. So we did find, we analyzed all the data we had in the metro area and found that the majority of the lakes are increasing in chloride concentrations. So even the ones that are still at lower levels, they're still at that maybe 50 to 60 milligram per liter level, which is below that threshold. They're still increasing over time because, yes, you have all of this impervious surface that's going to be draining into your surface waters.
Steve Lund, what's the balance for you? You work with MnDOT, and we should also say MnDOT is not the only agency out there that has trucks out there with salt in the winter, but what are the What are the ponderings you have in your office when you think about this?
Well, it's thanks for including me again. I want to point out that MnDOT acknowledges, and I think all road agencies acknowledge and recognize, that the environmental aspects of treating winter roads is a concern to us. Our snow fighters live in the communities that they fight snow in and attend church with those folks. So, you know, they are in tune with that dilemma, and I'll call it a dilemma, of delivering winter services to the citizens of Minnesota, keeping roads safe. But at the same time, those solutions that we do use do have an environmental consequence. So it's a balancing act that it can't be solved with an equation. You know, there's not a mathematical equation that we arrive at. We've done market research on our snow and ice services, and we've come up with our plowing goals and our plowing targets for fighting snow. And we shoot for those, and Minnesota citizens have very high expectations of mobility and driving in the winter, and we like to meet those expectations. But, you know, as far as how we work on the other side, you know, I think I break it down into two fronts. We work in the here and now with training of our snow fighters and technology and alternative chemicals. But we also want to look at the then and there with research efforts. Brooke talked about, you know, that the chloride iron has a difficult time breaking down or can't be broken down and combining and reverse osmosis. We'd like to start exploring, and we have been looking to research as how to prepare ourselves for the future. So even though we deliver the best services now with the least amount of salt that we can use, how in the future do we actually get out of the salt process?
I like the snow fighter label too, Steve. I've never heard that. So that's a nice name you give there. But, you know, there are examples. Give me a couple other examples, Steve, because, you know, you see photos of how we used to remove snow in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, you'd get a truck filled up with snow, right? Maybe you have a crane or something that can put snow into the back of a truck. And then these trucks would just go up to a lake and dump it in. Well, we don't do that anymore because we realize it's not just snow that melts and there's no consequence. So what are other things that happen when you're training snow fighters, as you call them? Other people might call them the drivers of the plows and things like that, to be very exacting when they're deploying this.
Yeah, so let me focus on that here and now efforts that we're doing, some more examples of that. Again, the three components that are training, we have a pretty in-depth training process. We even have a boot camp on the front end of our snow fighting season for all new snow fighters, a two-week training camp that we hold up in Camp Ripley that all new snow fighters are required to attend. But then in addition to that, we have annual winter prep training in every one of our eight districts that prepares our snow fighters for the upcoming season. And a big part of that is the emphasis on only using the right amount of materials in the right time in the right location. So again, a very strong emphasis for the MnDOT, Minnesota Department of Transportation, on training. new technology is an area, our second area of emphasis. And we, our snowplows are second to none. We have state-of-the-art snowplows in Minnesota, and we're working towards implementing in-cab computer snowfighter decision support in those, where our snowfighters have real-time weather data and real-time sensory data, such as pavement temperature sensors, that help them make the best decisions on how to fight the snow situation. And then the alternative chemicals was the third. Salt isn't always our best chemical of choice, depending on the temperature conditions. Salt loses its effectiveness at a certain temperature, and we want to have the ability to use alternative chemicals that will deliver performance without wasting additional salt.
Do we know, Mindy, if that other salt or, I'm sorry, the other chemicals, what effect they have?
Well, it depends on what chemicals you're talking about. I've heard some regions using carbohydrate-based things, so like beet sugar or cane syrup and that sort of thing. Certainly not toxic effects on aquatic ecosystems like salt would have, and would be have much less of an impact on ecosystem function.
Let's take a call here from Steve in Grand Marais, who has a question on this topic. Steve, go right ahead.
Yeah, you know, if you load the speed limit by 5 or 10 miles an hour, you could maintain public safety and still, and actually maybe even cut back on some of the salt and sands. And that's it.
All right, thanks for the comments. The, Brooke was nodding her head as you spoke there, Steve. Steve Lund, do you agree with that sentiment?
I agree that customer expectation has a lot to do with how this issue plays out. Again, Minnesota travelers have a pretty high expectation of mobility, and there's no question that does play into the services we deliver.
There's a tweet here, Brooke, from Connie that says, snow removal contractors are so afraid of getting sued, they're unwilling to reduce salt usage. Protection is needed. Do you agree with that? Is there a legal component here about protecting people from lawsuits that might actually play into this?
Yeah, absolutely. Over the last several years, we've got together with a variety of people who work either in winter maintenance or in water resource protection. And that was a common theme that would come up, that there is this fear from especially private contractors. They have the least amount of protections in place.
Insurance and stuff.
Yeah. Yes, from slip and fall lawsuits, that their customers, their clients think that they want to see a massive amount of salt because they feel safer if they see all the salt. If they don't see salt on the ground and somebody does fall and get hurt, then they are, you know, feel that they're liable for those lawsuits. And New Hampshire took an interesting approach to this. They also have some chloride impaired surface waters in their state, and they modeled a training program, which we have here, that we partnered with MnDOT on early on about 10 years ago to develop a training targeted towards those private applicators, giving that industry more information and resources on what they can do to use salt responsibly to make sure that we're smart salting, is kind of the term we've coined. And they went ahead and passed a law that gives the private applicators who have attended and are certified under that training program some additional protection if they were to be brought to court for slip and fall lawsuits.
You know, and I'm glad you brought that up, Brooke, because this report that Mindy was a part of does not just call out the Steve Lunds of the world and does not just call out MnDOT. Yes, that's part of the report, but here, again, reading from some of the coverage, homeowners and private businesses are to blame for about half the salt used each winter, and no one knows how much they're using. Steve Lund can give you a printout of how much each truck actually dropped on the roads, but you know, the facilities person here at NPR just throws ice or throws salt out there every time it snows.
Yes, absolutely. There is contribution from everybody. In Minnesota, the contribution from homeowners and the private sector is more on the 24%, because we do have a lot of cities and counties that are also putting down, and they're usually doing training.
And real quick, 24%, you're saying for all of Minnesota? Or
for the Twin Cities metro area.
Okay, so that's 24%, and so what I'm reading here about half, because that full report had to do with all these lakes across U.S. and Canada. I'm just trying to explain why there's a difference in those numbers. So you're saying 24%.
Yeah, that's a more localized percentage for what we were calculated based on salt purchasing records. And so it is a significant part of the problem, and considering that they are up against this fear of lawsuits, mm-hmm. and maybe they want to use less salt, but then if they do, they could have some negative consequences, you know, in that increased liability. And so it's really important, I think, that we come up with innovative solutions for how can we get everybody on board, because we've already got MnDOT on board. They're doing a great job already at implementing the latest technologies and using as little amount of salt as is necessary to provide public safety. And so how do we get everybody, including homeowners, to get on board and maybe change their expectations? What if we did change our expectations for how fast we got around in the winter and took some pressure off of our winter maintenance professionals?
Mindy, the other thing here that they talk about, and I didn't realize this, but the recommendation is when you're putting down salt on your sidewalk, apparently the recommendation here is you should be thinking, this is the quote from one of the stories, you should be thinking of teaspoons, not cups. All you need is a few crystals to work effectively on ice. Well, I can confirm from just living in the Twin Cities that nobody follows that recommendation. More is better is what I see when I see salt thrown down on sidewalks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true, and homeowners and business owners just need to really try to be cognizant of using the minimum possible amount of salt. Really what is going to do the job, and not, you know, our tendency is just to dump it on. So.
And I just wanted to add that we do have some short training videos available on the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's website. There's one that is geared towards homeowners. So, mm-hmm. you know, it gives you specific visual pictures of here's what the right amount of salt looks like. And we also have a training video for people who might work at your front desk who go out and throw that salt out. We actually mm-hmm. have a training video that our local partners helped put together yeah. that we have available on our website.
I have to think about, you know, office buildings with all these employees coming in, and just, again, we go back to that threat of lawsuit. I mean, I guess the other way of thinking about this, Brooke, would be maybe to pass a law that says, people, it's Minnesota, it's winter, and if you fall... That sometimes happens in Minnesota in winter.
And that is the approach that New Hampshire took. They have a liability law with their ski resorts saying that if you come and ski here, it's an inherently dangerous activity. Mm-hmm. And if you get hurt, you know, that's not our fault,
not
essentially.
Our fault.
We don't have that same type of language anywhere here in Minnesota. So it's a little different of a culture in New Hampshire versus Minnesota. And so that would be something that we would just need to think about as we move forward in trying to address this.
Steve, does MnDOT have an opinion on that, about things like shoring up some of the liability laws to get at this?
Well, I think a big part that protects or that helps public agencies is that we have a plan of attack and that we follow that plan. It provides us some assurance that we're doing things according to procedures that we've laid out. So we're pretty confident in our approaches. I think, as was mentioned, we have a significant process to train our employees, and we want to be part of the solution. In fact, we want to help lead the solution to it. So we do think we're on the right course with this. But there's no silver bullet right there. This isn't a Minnesota problem only. It's not a Minnesota or a United States problem only. This issue is all over the world. I mm-hmm. read a recent research report out of the Scandinavian countries that said the Scandinavian countries are using 600,000 tons of salt annually. And the Scandinavian countries are very water savvy, but yeah. yet they still are at a point where they're using significant salt.
Let's get a couple calls here. There's a couple people on the line here with ideas, alternatives, and they want us to talk about it a little bit. So Frank and Edina, briefly, what's your thought here? What are you asking about as an alternative? Frank, are you there? All right, let's go to Kristen in Minneapolis on line 5. Hi, Kristen. What's your thought here today about an alternative?
Hi. Yeah, I'm just really confused why there isn't more of a conversation about using sand instead of salt mm-hmm. or in combination with salt, because that's what we did growing up here in Minneapolis, and it worked great. You could always see the sand when it was laid out, so you knew you had enough, and you didn't have to oversalt. And salt doesn't even work if it's too cold outside or if it's not sunny.
All right, thanks for that. And let's go right away before we talk about Christian's idea to Charlie, who's in Blaine on line 4. Hi, Charlie. What's your thoughts?
Well, I was just wondering if this chloride is if it's conductive at all, if a series of anodes or cathodes or whatever could be put in the surface water, and would it like attract and trap the chloride that's there and bring down the chloride levels over time?
Thanks for that. And then one final question online from John, who uses cat litter. Is that better? So, Brooke, we have sand, we have cat litter, and we have Charlie's idea of trying to get into the water in a way to collect the sand. Go through those real quick.
Well, we have heard a lot about the sand and the cat litter and other kind of more grit type of material.
Cheese brine.
Yeah. Well, the cheese brine, that's, you know, not a grit. That would be an alternative like the beet juice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Steve will probably be able to chime in better on this. But from what my understanding is that that sand and that cat litter are great for those really cold temperatures when salt doesn't work. But sand isn't going to melt ice. And with the high level of expectations that we have from the public, it's not going to be able to meet that same level that they have kind of gotten accustomed to, unfortunately.
Steve, thoughts on that?
Just add a little to that. Sand does not provide any of that melting action. And what we have found, sand is a very temporary fix for a temporary traction. It ends up in our ditches, and it does clog ditches, and it ultimately will lead to sedimentation in the waters of the state. So we don't believe we get the return in performance from sand with the consequences that it still has. However, we still have that tool in our toolbox. We just do not use it as much as we used to.
Does sand, Mindy, or cat litter, how does that affect when it runs off into the lakes? Will cat litter kill fishes too? If the cats don't kill the fish, will the cat litter kill the fish?
Goodness. Well, I'm not sure exactly what's in cat litter. Mm-hmm. It is a desiccant, so there could be things associated with it that would be bad. But
I mean, a lot of them are of a clay base or substance.
Yeah, so they might be similar to sand in terms of, as Steve pointed out, causing sedimentation or turbidity and whatnot. Certainly, it would be less toxic than salt.
And then, Steve, the final note there, cheese brine and beet juice and all of that. I mean, a lot of articles written about that. And you don't foresee the day that we'll ever fully switch over to something like that?
We are very open to any alternative chemical. We've tried most of them, including these byproducts of the ag industry. Many of those do have, though, chemicals or elements in them that make them of environmental concern. We belong to a Pacific Northwest snow fighting service that analyzes all of the chemicals we use, because we got to make sure we know what we're putting down. And but we're open for any opportunity to find a better product.
Final seconds here, Brooke. A lot of this, your theme seems to be this is a lot about us and what we expect to be able to do in the winter.
Absolutely. I think that if we have a huge role as just citizens of Minnesota, that if we want to really protect our water resources, how can we be part of the solution? How can we support our snow fighters and what they're doing? Because they're really only out there for us, to provide us with the level of safety that we're demanding. And so what can we do as citizens to alleviate some of that pressure and take on some of the responsibility ourselves?
Brooke Oslison from the MPCA, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Mindy Morales-Williams from the U, one of the authors of this report. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Steve Lund from MnDOT. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for including me.